Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before we begin today's exposition, if you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We've come to chapter 6. This narrative showcases the heart of David. It gives us an inside glimpse of the king's humility before God, of his spirit of dependence on him, and of the king's passion to honor God as King of Kings. Now, David, again, gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose, and he went with all the people who were with him to Baal-Judah, Kiriath-Jearim, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name, capital M, the very name of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the Ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the cart. So they brought it with the Ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the Ark. Meanwhile, David, with all the house of Israel, were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, with lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. And Uzzah died there by the Ark of God. We read in verse 8 that David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And that place was then there named Perez Uzzah to this day, meaning the breakthrough of Uzzah. So David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can I bring the Ark of the Lord to me?" That is, in Jerusalem. David was unwilling to move the Ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Thus the Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all of his household. We'll stop right there. We have here an exhibit of the priority of worship in David's scheme of things. This man, as I've said before, defined the theocentric personality. That word, theocentric, means God-centered. It was not all about David, it was all about God. The next recorded move that David makes it clear that David knew his place in the food chain, so to speak. God was the sovereign creator. David saw himself as the Lord's humble caretaker, whose duty it was to see that God was honored appropriately by David personally and by the people of Israel. So here in this narrative, David takes steps to reinstate the proper worship of Israel. This worship had broken down way back there in the times of Eli, the period of the Judges, when the Philistines had taken the Ark as a trophy of war. Later they were forced to return it when plagues broke out among its host cities. For many long years, the Ark of God had been stored in the custody of Levite families. There was no central worship according to the prescribed regulations of the law. David rightly wanted to change all that to the glory of God. So he sets about, early in his reign, after his monarchy was firmly established, and he was settled in the city of David, what we call Jerusalem, as his new capital. And he wanted the ark, which symbolized the presence of God, there with him. In terms of his agenda, David stands as a spiritual model for us all. Though a king, he knew his place in the world. Or should we say, David knew of God's place, and he humbly set about early in his reign for his own sake, and as the leader of his people, for their sake, to make every effort to get himself and his nation spiritually centered around Yahweh. For a very long time, dating back to the period of the Judges, when, as I mentioned, in the time of Eli and his debauched priestly sons, the Philistines had overrun the army of Israel, captured the Ark of God, which symbolized the seed of God's presence among his people, and then were forced to send it back to Israel, as we said, after plagues broke out upon them. Shortly thereafter, the Ark was turned over to the custody of a Levite living in Baali, Judah, or Kiriath Jearim, as it's otherwise known. That Levite was one by the name of Abinadab. There it had been resting under his roof for many long years. By this time and in this venue, we can surmise that the Ark has lost some of its sacred mystery. It has lost some of its shine, as some might say. To David, the Ark is a big deal. And because of what it represented, David treated it as such, as we're going to see momentarily. The problem was the Ark and its transfer from Baali, Judah, was more of a sacred object and a sacred march orchestrated by David and by the people of Israel enlisted in this holy pageant, kind of like a pastor treating something as very holy and ordering up ceremony to punctuate that fact, and the congregation just going along with it in form but not fully getting it in spirit. And that's the situation that day. Well, that had to change. And the Lord picks this occasion as a severe but very teachable moment to send to all concerned a message that he is a great and holy God. He is not one to be taken lightly, and he's a God who takes deep offense when those things associated so intimately with him are not treated with deference and the dignity they should be. Typical for the Lord, this profanity toward holy things had been festering and building for years and years, and in great mercy and patience, God bided his time for the right time. And here, at this right time, he makes his point in a way that set everybody back with one holy whoa. David, as king, orders up a huge processional to bring the ark up from its humble residence in a no-name town under the care of a lowly Levite. Everything was rightly intended by King David to make the transition to Jerusalem in a manner worthy of God. That was all to the good on David's part, though, as I said, given the very low spiritual oil of the nation at this time, a carryover from the dark centuries of the Judges, the people did it, but they, for the most part, did not get it. It was orchestrated by David, but in spirit, not really entered into by all the people. David didn't send a committee with a commission to bring up the ark. No, no. In verses 1 and 2, in fact, he again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000 of the military elite, not humble, ill-trained citizen soldiers, but in short, the best of the lot, and he accompanied them to the humble resting place of the ark. Its environment was quite a contradiction to its sacred meaning. For the ark, it is emphasized, is called by the name, capital M, the unmentionable name of the Lord of Hosts, or the Lord of forces or armies in heaven above, the one who is enthroned symbolically above the cherubim of the ark. The cherubim were of one piece with the mercy seat of the ark, hovering over the mercy seat. All of this language is designed to say that that box in itself was associated with the name of God and all that that name stands for. Thus, it oozed, as it were, with sacral ambience. It was ever so holy, and now that David, who understands that, is about to transfer it to Jerusalem, God, sovereignly, chooses this event and what transpired to drive a stake in the ground and reaffirm it in a stunning way. I mean for my name, represented by this ark, to be treated as supremely holy. Been a long time since that had happened. Whatever had been missing in their spirit at the time, at least formally, David and the priest involved in this project got it right, at least at first. Everything about this procession said this ark was an extraordinary religious object. Handle with care was all over it. To underscore that, they took the trouble to find a brand new cart, not an old and used farm cart, to carry it. The new cart, symbolizing purity or holiness, something set apart, not one used for common purposes. Now, that was all good. The two sons of Abinadab, they were Levites themselves. They were conscripted to lead the new cart containing the ark along the road from the hill where the ark had been stored for all these years. In verse 4, in keeping with the sanctity of it all, the king had it all arranged that as the sacred ark moved along its appointed way, David and all the populace amassed for this occasion were fittingly celebrating its passage with all manner of musical instruments, verse 5, like some celestial orchestra. I would have loved to have heard that music. The text doesn't mention it, but I think we can assume singers must have accompanied the instruments, the latter being mentioned to give us a sense of the musical scale of this thing. This was no hokey affair. It was all carried off as best they could in a fashion worthy of a majesty. That's the atmosphere of the narrative. Until they came to the threshing floor of a certain Nacon, where due to some obstacle or circumstance unmentioned in the text, the ark was almost tipped over, somehow, by the oxen pulling the cart. Of course, at that point, Uzzah, fearing the worst, reflexively grabbing hold of the tottering ark to prevent it from falling off the cart. What could possibly be wrong with that? Well, the Lord obviously found quite a lot wrong with what Uzzah, the Levite, did, because we read that the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. Whoa! The narrator tells us exactly why God punished Uzzah. But David at the moment didn't get the message. He was not only perplexed by what happened to Uzzah, who on the face of things only did what any person in his place would have done, and yet God killed him. He struck him down on the spot. Well, David was upset. In verses 7 and 8, we're told that in the wake of what God did, David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. Have you ever been mad at God? Well, David, great and godly man that he was so mystified by God's behavior on this occasion that the text flatly said, David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. The whole episode made quite an impression that day, so much so that they even named the spot where God struck Uzzah, Perez-Uzzah, meaning the breakthrough of Uzzah. Now, before I try to explain why the Lord striking Uzzah was nothing over the top as it first appears, let's talk a minute about this business of getting mad at the Lord. Consciously, at least, I've experienced that only once in my life, but on that occasion, I was truly in that mode. I relate the story in my book, Polishing God's Monuments. Just when we think, like David, that we have the Lord and His ways pretty much dialed in, and we get in some kind of comfort zone of expectation, the Lord will do something totally unexpected, totally out of the box, as far as we're concerned, and He will in some cases not just baffle us, but the Lord will frustrate us perhaps to the point of anger, like a child getting angry with a parent whose ways they do not understand. Ordinarily, that is an explosion of human weakness, not ingrained wickedness. And God seems to be remarkably merciful and patient with us in that temporary mode. Jonah's a great example. What we have to beware of is letting that anger form a root, a faith-withering root of bitterness in our souls. Sometimes, folks, we just need to let God be God. It's what Job had to learn. Let God be infinitely bigger than ourselves, which, of course, He is. Just learn to have a high threshold of mystery and get over it, over the hump, in faith. Well, that brings us to the question, what on earth was the big deal here? Uzzah was struck down for the irreverence embedded in his action. The text plainly pinpoints it, doesn't it? Here I think the point is that Uzzah in particular was seen by God as a representative of the general spirit of irreverence that infected the vast majority of the people. Though to the outside observer it may seem that what Uzzah did was simply a totally natural reaction to the threat presented by the stumbling oxen pulling the cart that carried the Ark of God. You see, there's God Himself who knows the hearts of all people. And God knew the interior man, I'm talking about Uzzah, as well as the heart of the throng in general. God knew, despite benign rather than malign outward appearances, God knew that familiarity in the house of Abinadab had bred a certain contempt for the ark. Familiarity, you know, breeds contempt. That ark was so sacred by dint of its intimate association with the presence of God that the Lord, if we may say so, was fed up with it. In the time of Moses and Joshua, the ark was so sacred, like the name of God Himself, which the Israelites dared not even to pronounce, that nobody treated the ark in such a familiar way, especially one who was only a Levite and not a priest, even if trying to rescue it from potential damage. God saw, you see, beyond the surface actions of Uzzah. That's what David and we ourselves could not see if we were not told. God saw the heart of the man, and as intimated above, God saw in Uzzah a familiarity that had bred contempt. God saw in Uzzah a type of a spiritual pathology affecting the nation in general. God saw in this action of Uzzah an expression of the low state of reverence for God, a general spiritual condition in which their sense of the sacred had been reduced and now needed to be revived. And God picked this moment to do it. So the Lord made an example of Uzzah. It's a just example, because the Lord knew his heart, and God seized the moment to send the message to the whole nation. Hear now, I am a holy God, and I want to be treated by my people with the reverence and honor due my great name. Now, if one were to respond that it certainly seems that in this elaborately orchestrated procession that David and Israel were doing just that, it only shows us how facilely we confuse religious pomp and circumstance, that is, high-toned religious formalism, with true reverence, which proceeds from the heart and endows all the outward trappings. That God can see. You and I can't. By his actions, God sent a loud and clear message that in this instance, the heart of reverence was seriously deficient in the whole proceeding. And in Uzzah, as a prime example, the Lord struck Uzzah to raise the consciousness of all the people, David included, to just how holy a God he is, and how deferentially the Lord expected his people and his king to treat him at all times. From this ancient episode, we all can be refreshed in its lessons. I'll mention four. Our God is an unimaginably holy God. He takes deep offense when his people, especially, fail to treat him with appropriate reverence. And I think we are very much like those people. I don't know if any of us have any idea, and know just how merciful God is, with our lack of an idea, how holy he is. That brings up the second lesson in that connection. Just because God does not strike us as he once struck Uzzah, when we fail to treat the Lord as holy, that mercy should never be construed by us as evidence that God is good with our all too familiar ways of treating him. A third lesson, God's patience in making his point is both good news and bad news. It is good news in that it shows the mercy and the long-suffering of God with us. When we insult His holiness, He's merciful, patient in giving us time and space to make amends. It is bad news in that it serves as a warning shot across our bows that sooner or later the Lord will make, as in the case of Uzzah, His point severely if, having time and space, we do not correct ourselves. There is a fourth lesson. God treats our behaviors in penetrating ways that others cannot. God knows how to read human conduct for what it really is at bottom, and not what it seems like. And God will hold people accountable for what it is if we do not wake up and amend our ways. We don't like to talk these days much about the holiness of God. Everybody wants to talk about the love of God. Nothing wrong with that. God is love. But we forget that the love of God does not exist apart from the holiness of God. And if we did not see the holiness of God, there's large parts of the love of God we would never see. Part of the love of God is that God hates evil, and God is no respecter of persons. Well, this whole episode just blew David away. Suddenly it was like a hot potato. The king feared to have the ark around him in Jerusalem. It seemed now something was so utterly sacred and its holy protocol so breakable, like crystal, that the ark was just too dangerous to risk having with him in Jerusalem. So the ark was immediately diverted to the nearest priestly residence for safekeeping until David could let the dust settle and take stock. David no longer had a comfort zone with it. No matter how right it had at first seemed, and no matter how godly his original intentions were, he was afraid to bring the ark to Jerusalem. He didn't want a repetition of the Uzzah episode. Sometimes, folks, you and I have the best intentions. Like Moses in his first well-intentioned but ill-fated attempt, when at age 40 he stepped up and offered himself to be the Savior of his Hebrew people. Well, that goal was God's will for Moses. Only problem was the timing and the preparation were off. You see, it was that time around Moses' initiative, not God's. But there's something important in the process that is unintentionally out of phase or off key. And when our project fails or falls apart, if we listen to the Lord in those circumstances, it will usually come to us after some processing what the problem was, and then we can move on in God's right way, whatever that is. Way back when I was teaching in Bible college and seminary, I would get on some of the more gifted guys, more than those who were not really all that gifted. And I would tell them, as I critiqued them, that they had the evil Knievel syndrome. I would tell them that they were 6 inches short of greatness, referring to the great showman's attempt to bridge the Snake River Canyon on his motorcycle, and he fell just a little short. Hadn't been for nets, it would have been fatally short. Well, sometimes men like David are treated a little more searchingly with the Lord because they're just 6 inches short of greatness. In this episode, you see, God was sending David to finishing school. David got it, but he wanted David to really get it, to go from aha to aha. So it took a while, 3 months and a lot of processing, for the meaning of it all to sink into David. But God mercifully so works through circumstances that the king gets it, and a renewed attempt comes about after David learns how the Lord had blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belonged to him. And so he begins again to launch an effort to bring the ark safely to Jerusalem, the new capital of the nation. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.